Okay, good morning, everyone. My talk is, will be about 50%, maybe even more experimental, or at least experimentally motivated. And the title is here, as you have seen it, but subtitle maybe just somewhere below. I will try to address some of the specific questions, aiming at making some of the common models realistic. And essentially, my interest to these problems arose from just coming across some of the real materials and real phenomena, and we try to understand what's really going on in some of them. So in a sense, my talk will be kind of a collection of special topics and special materials related, generally speaking, to different possibilities to get spin gaps. And in particular, and this is more or less the scope. I will pay about half of the time probably to spin pile system, and maybe one of the systems which was initially supposed to be spin piles, but we now believe that something else is going on here. And then I will just probably skip this part, although this is interesting class of systems, but it will be discussed in more details in next talk, and probably I won't have time simply. If I have, I will say a few words about these two. And then the end, this is actually, this topic is arose also from discussion of one experiment, but it's more theoretical in a sense. So maybe I will start by very quickly just flashing some of the possibilities to get spin gaps, and we have heard about some of them already yesterday, and probably we'll hear a lot more today and maybe other days. So simplest thing, of course, is if there exists dimers which are simply defined by structural dimers. This is one of the new systems, by the way, which is studied now in Japan, which also belongs to this class, or there are some other compounds like VOPO and many others. Now, if such dimers do not exist structurally, they may appear spontaneously due to certain instabilities. The most famous one is goes back to piles instability, but in magnetic system it's usually called spin piles, and especially interest to this system was motivated by a recent discovery of first inorganic spin piles compound. And then there are also some other, like spin pile system, appearance of spin gap infiltration and letters, but I won't touch about these topics. It will be discussed in detail in many other systems. So I will start by just discussing spin piles system. And actually the idea of spin piles transition theoretically was discussed quite a while ago, but for a long time there was no experimental or very few experimental objects to apply to. Mostly these were some organic materials, and it's rather difficult to work with organic materials. And very recently, not very recently, okay, a few years ago already, first inorganic spin piles material was discovered, and now there exists a lot of experimental studies of this material because very good single crystals are available, and you can dope it and you can study many different things. So main structural motif of this material is shown here. This is linear chain of couples, and they are connected by two oxygens with angle approximately 90 degrees. That's a big difference as compared to cuprates. In cuprates, high-TC cuprates, oxygen is usually sitting just exactly in between coppers, so that's 180 degrees. Here it's close to 90. So there are a lot of things which were studied for spin piles materials, in particular copper germanate. I will address very qualitatively these two. First question is, why spin piles phenomena, why spin piles transition is observed so rarely? Why is it so uncommon? In principle, we have a lot of different low-dimensional magnetic material, quasi-one-dimensional material. But most of them, usually at low temperatures, order three-dimensionally, and That's one of the questions. And what's so specific for copper germinate? Why it prefers to go along the spin piles route and not along magnetic route? And second problem is, what is the effect of doping on spin piles materials? So this is general structure which I just explained you. And now I will show you maybe just again flash. What are the properties which motivated this description? This is first experiment, susceptibility, which has more or less rounded maximum, which is not exactly Bonner-Fisher. Bonner-Fisher would have been much higher, and that's now ascribed to the fact that there is not only nearest neighbor, but also next nearest neighbor direction, that's frustrated chain. But what is important is that below 14 Kelvin, susceptibility drops and essentially exponentially, and people, just by fitting all these curves, they estimated parameters and exchange integral in one dimensional exchange integral is about 100 Kelvin, TC is 14, and energy gap is, I think, about 20. So 2 delta over TC is close to BCF value, close to 3.5. This is how this material looks in real life. So these are these chains, these crosses are coppers, this is this oxygen plaquette. Actually, oxygen is forming octahedra, elongated octahedra, copper is always elongated octahedra. So they are forming sheets, and actually these chains running along C direction, like this. Then very important is the fact that response of this material to some external pressure, for instance, is very often stronger, not for this direction along the chain, but perpendicular along the sheets. And that's also one of the questions we wanted to understand. Okay. Now, first I will just try to formulate at least the question which I formulated already previously, explain a little bit. What determines whether one-dimensional, quasi-one-dimensional material would develop spin piles state or would be long-range ordered magnetically? Here is standard simple description. We have Heisenberg interaction, and exchange constant depends on distance between sites, and this can be expressed like this. And of course, we have also to add some lattice energy, lattice energy, or I can write in terms of phonons. And we can introduce dimensionless coupling constant describing interaction of spin with phonons or spin with lattice. And now, to overcome three-dimensional magnetic ordering, we usually have some interaction J perpendicular between chains in addition to interaction along the chains J. And this perpendicular interaction could make system three-dimensionally ordered. Usually it does. And now to we have to compete with three-dimensional magnetic ordering. And we have to compare not only critical temperature, which in the simplest BCS-like or mean field-like expression for weak coupling would be given by this standard expression. But for weak coupling, we have actually to compare energy gain, which in this weak coupling case for spin pile case is T square over J. We have to compare it with magnetic energy gain, which is of order of magnetic temperature of J perpendicular. And that's why, essentially, that's very difficult for many materials to exceed magnetic energy. For that we need usually rather large coupling or rather soft lattice. And that's one of the problems. Why? What is soft in copper germinate? Actually, this question led us to the idea that actually this spin pile transition copper germinate is induced not so much by stretching, by changing of distances between sites, but in real material, angles are even more important. And this is actually what we can call bond bending model, not bond stretching model, but bond bending model. And for that I have to go back to kind of quantum chemistry, if you like, or basics of exchange interaction. This is this copper and two coppers bound by oxygen. And it can be easily shown that if this angle is close to 90 degrees, then exchange interaction occurs via two different oxygen orbitals in contrast to high TC cooperate. And in this case, 90-degree exchange is known to be even ferromagnetic. That's one of the Goodenough Kanamori Anderson rules. That was actually also one of the first questions, why we have antiferromagnetic interaction. But what is important, that this interaction is very sensitive to this angle. This angle is slightly more than 90 degrees. And what happens at the transition, I have now a toy model which shows what indeed happens. And this is actually confirmed by direct neutron studies made mostly by Marcus Braddon in Saclay. So this is actually my toy model. These are these coppers and oxygens. Angle is slightly more than 90 degrees. And now what happens is that one of these octahedra does something like this, and another does something like this. So they alternate like this. And strangely enough, these two coppers come closer together, but angle becomes close to 90 degrees. So exchange interaction becomes weaker, not stronger here, but weaker, because this angle is 90. And this is close to 180, this is stronger. So this gives rise to this alternation of exchange interaction. And this is now indeed confirmed experimentally. There is also another part of the story which is connected with germanium, which is sitting around, but I also have this toy model, but I have no time probably to to show it to you. But this can explain why this is very sensitive to some pressure or some deformation perpendicular to the chains. Because in this deformation we just squeeze or do these things.
So why it doesn't become ferromagnetic?
Well, actually it is it doesn't become ferromagnetic because of one particular problem. This is actually illustrated here. I wanted to skip it, but if you ask, I can explain you. This, there is germanium sitting and bound to this oxygen. So there is exchange interaction path which goes via germanium, via side group. Usually side groups are completely ignored in super exchange interaction, but here it is important. So this gives rise to the fact that this super exchange path is antiferromagnetic. And it competes with simply direct ferromagnetic interaction, and we made some very detailed calculation, and it's indeed sufficient to overcome this direct ferromagnetic exchange, because ferromagnetic is also small with respect to J Hund's over U ratio. And this is not small, but that's actually the germanium gives rise to the fact that it's also sensitive to the position of the germanium.
But if the oxygen goes down, then this ferromagnetic interaction through the germanium will become...
One of them becomes really close to zero. Actually, there are some materials, for instance, these famous telephone number compounds, which contains both letters and chains. And chains are exactly like this, but do not have side groups. And exchange interaction in these chains is indeed weakly ferromagnetic. So there are such systems. This, I just forgot, oxygen 41, this strontium 14, copper, I just forgot all the numbers. But it contains one of the part is this one-dimensional chains, which exactly is the same structure as this one, but without these side groups. And this interaction, exchange interaction in this one is really weakly ferromagnetic. Okay. Now, second problem which I wanted to address is influence of doping. Doping was done for this copper germanate, and we can substitute different things. Either we can substitute copper by non-magnetic ions like zinc, or we can substitute germanium by silicon. And, well, I lost this, all this. Here it is, and here is the phase diagram, which at first, when it first was observed, discovered, it was a bit of surprise. When you substitute either germanium by silicon or copper by zinc, qualitatively the behavior is the same, only the scale is slightly different. Spin pile transition is rather rapidly suppressed, but instead you obtain long-range antiferromagnetic order. And for certain composition, for certain concentration range, there is actually coexistence of both spin piles or single formation and long-range antiferromagnetic order. How is it possible? Now, usually we are used to think that disorder, doping, they suppress all the order. Here we obtain long-range order by this, by inducing distortion. Now, Explanation, qualitative explanation is rather straightforward. Mathematical formulation is a bit more elaborate, but I won't go into the details. What is the qualitative picture? Suppose I make simplest substitution. I substitute copper by zinc. Zinc is non-magnetic, and essentially what it does, it cuts my chains into finite segments. And if it does it randomly, then some of the segments may have even number of sides, and they are quite happy. And some of them can have odd number of sides, and in odd number of odd segments, there should be necessarily one particular spin which can be localized, either close to impurity or far away from impurity. And in actually, if we treat it more rigorously, we can show that these impurities they induce kinks or solitons, like this, or it's the same as spinons. And for isolated chains, they prefer to be not close to impurity, but rather far away. They repel from the ends. And they also repel from one another. If I consider interacting impurity, there is a phenomenon which is very similar to interacting chains. There is a phenomenon very similar to confinement. Suppose I have this magnetic impurity here, and to the left, these two chains are in phase. They want to be in phase. Suppose they want to be in phase. Now, each impurity, it shifts the phase of order parameter by pi, by half. So now, instead of being in phase, all these distances, they are out of phase. So we lose perpendicular interaction, and this energy loss is proportional to the length. So it's essentially my potential energy is linear in distance, and this potential energy pulls my soliton back to impurity. Now, why is antiferromagnetic? Again, it's qualitatively rather simple. Again, suppose I start with simply this spin pile system and put one localized spin here. It polarizes this magnetic singlet states so that it induces certain magnetization which is alternates and decays with certain correlation length. And if these clouds of neighboring solitons or neighboring localized spins start to overlap, finally we can get a long-range magnetic order, which of course is modulated somehow. It's not the same, magnetization is not the same in all the sites, it's modulated, but still it's long-range magnetic order, and experimentally it's really very clearly seen. And theoretically... Sorry?
I mean, you would still need two-dimensional interaction?
Yeah, of course. Of course, to get long-range order, of course I need two-dimensional interaction. But it's also true also for spin-pile transition itself. Because in simple one-dimensional chain, it shouldn't have any real phase transition. And the fact that it does tells us that interaction between chains is really crucial. And usually, this interaction between chains for spin piles phenomena is provided by three-dimensional phonons. Essentially, phonons or elastic interaction is always three-dimensional, always long-range. It's usually treated classically. That's a special problem. What if it's not? But, okay, that... And theoretical phase diagram, which was obtained, actually I forgot to tell that this work on spin pile transition is to a large extent done by bright theoretician Groening and Maxim Mostovoy. That's mostly his achievement. And that is actually a phase diagram which we obtained, spin pile phase. Now there is certain coexistence phase, which in our case has finite range. Experimentally, that's still not clear in this experimental phase diagram. Experimentalists do not know whether there exist certain critical concentration starting from which antiferromagnetism begins, or this critical concentration is actually zero. So maybe already from very low concentration this antiferromagnetic state appears. That's not
real.
This is a silicon doping, but just because of the fact that essentially the same question you asked me. Why for 90 degree the Keynesian direction is antiferromagnetic? That's in our opinion is due to germanium. When we substitute germanium by silicon, it strongly modifies this side group effect, and that essentially leads to the same effect that Keynesian direction is essentially becomes zero or maybe even slightly ferromagnetic. That's why silicon is also very efficient in cutting the chains. And it's even experimentally that's a bit of a puzzle, because it's even three times more efficient than zinc. So there is a scaling. You need, say, three times more zinc to suppress as strongly as silicon. But silicon couples to two chains simultaneously. That's a factor of two. And other things, I have no good explanation why that. Well, when silicon comes, it's what it does. It also cuts the chain. It also cuts the chain into finite segments, not by substituting magnetic ion by non-magnetic, but simply by changing exchange direction, cutting the bond, because the bond, the silicon, this particular exchange interaction between these two cutters. If it's germanium here, it's anti-ferromagnetic. If it's silicon here, then the exchange interaction between these two guys is essentially zero.
Silicon also creates random fields, which dilution does. So I agree that it's somewhat different.
Maybe that's an extra factor. That's why it's very efficient. Yep. But, well, I think that it's also acts differently on next nearest neighbor exchange, but that's a special, again, a special thing.
Well, very recently we call this material that you completely substitute germanium by silicon wafer. There is a copper silicate.
Okay, and what does it do? I'm not aware of that.
It's at lower temperature, and it's not quite clear what it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I would like to hear more of that. Well,
I think we should let.
Okay. Maybe after this extensive investigation of copper germanate, we were all very happy when this paper appeared. That was a group of Yutaku Eda from Tokyo, who claimed to observe possibly second spin pyrite transition in sodium vanadate. And this system is made in the following way. It, originally, it was believed to contain chains of magnetic vanadium. Actually, if you count valence, then you see that vanadium has equal number of vanadium 4 plus, which contains spin 1 half, and 5 plus, which contains 0, no spin at all. And it was originally assumed that it alternating chains, say magnetic, non-magnetic, magnetic, non-magnetic. And this is behavior of susceptibility. After subtracting a very large background, people just were convinced that there is indeed a spin gap. And there are direct indications that there is a spin gap now by Newton. Now, this system is made out of layers, essentially. And the layers are maybe presented like this. Here are on the vertices of plaquettes are oxygens. And vanadiums are sitting more or less in between. Actually, they are sitting in five-fold coordinates in this pyramid, more or less in the middle, but slightly above and below. In this pyramid, some of them are looking towards, some of them are looking in opposite direction. But if you just look at what exchange interactions are, then you immediately see that strongest exchange interaction is in these directions along the runs. Much weaker exchange interaction is along the legs. So essentially, that's very similar to leather compound, but with one important difference in comparison with copper cuprate leather, that here we have not one spin per or one electron per side, but one electron per two sides, or one electron per rung. And originally, as I said, it was assumed that here, for instance, you have magnetic sites, here you have non-magnetic. Again, magnetic, non-magnetic. But more recent structural investigations which were carried out, which were done simultaneously in several groups, in particular one in Groningen by Tom Pastra and his group, they have proven that actually in high temperature phase, both these vanadiums are equivalent. So there is a first question, why then this system behaves as insulating? Because if you have this half field leather, it could be even metallic. And why it behaves as one-dimensional? Answer comes from the following problem.